Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shape Me. If you're on the Kent coast, you can come and buy it from The Market Bookshop, my lovely local. This week, our guest is the writer, MP and feminist firefighter, Jess Phillips. Jess is the MP for Birmingham Yardley and the author of Every Woman, One Woman's Truth About Speaking the Truth, and her brand new book is Truth to Power, 7 Ways to Call Time on BS, which is out this month. I've loved Jess for a long time because she is compassionate, courageous, and committed to using her voice in order to make sure that as many people as possible are heard. She's also one of the funniest people on Twitter. We went to Birmingham to have a rifle through her shelves and chat about Margaret Atwood, Sue Townsend, and why Matilda is a superhero who inspires boys and girls. So I'm going to do a little bit of scene switching. We're in the spare room. Is that all right, by the way?
It's a beautiful
sort of like melanine shelf. And I don't know.
This is
a very cool selection. If you were sort of staying, you know, if you had an overnight guest, I see Adrian Mole, Stig of the Dump, Philip Pullman. There was a Douglas Copeland one I saw, but I'd never.
All families are psychotic.
I don't know that book, but it sounds amazing.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant book.
Is it a novel?
Mm-hmm. I read it years and years ago. It was my friend Alex. It was her. It was her favourite book, and it is about a sort of fam. It's as basic as just being about a family, but they are all mad and having a pop at each other all the time.
Well, that's part of most books, isn't
it? Indeed.
So when did you, is this your friend's copy or is this?
It may well be. I think it might have been her copy. Or
Alex, most, if you're listening.
Yes, Alex, thanks for that. Most of the books that I have are usually stolen from my mum and dad. I used to steal books off my mum all the time.
So were they big readers when you grew up? Were they?
My dad reads books like. Every book that he ever reads is the best book he's ever read. And so, like, whatever he's reading is like, you must read this. It's the most important book ever. But he thinks that about every single book. But my mum was the most avid reader. She would read. So we'd go on holiday and she'd have to take a suitcase full of books because she would get through them. She'd read a novel in a day, every single day. But if you asked her anything about them, and I do suffer from this, she'd be like, oh, I don't know, I remember there was a girl in it. Like, she would have been instantly forget the book. And she once claimed that in War and Peace, she only read the peace bits. Because the war bits were boring. But my mum would just, like, you know, every book a list, she would buy every single one of them and just get through them in a week. And she was an avid reader, my mum.
Now, at the time of recording, I don't know if we might know who has won the Booker. When this goes out, do you have any?
I haven't read any of them, I don't think.
Because the Testaments came out, which is obviously it's weird, isn't it? It's like it's an event, it's taken on a life of its own. Are you an Atwood fan? Will you be reading?
I am an Atwood fan, and I did an event on the launch of the Testaments for a charity called Equality Now, linked to the book. And I was asked when was the first time you read The Handmaid's Tale, and everybody had these like amazing stories to tell about how they'd been at university, and they felt it was like they were reading it and they felt it was totally claustrophobic and like it had a feminist awakening in them. But I was like 14 when I read The Handmaid's Tale, again from my mum. My mum was like, you must read this book. And I just remember thinking it was like science fiction dystopia, like Brave New World. It didn't particularly reach me on a feminist level, but as I've got older and watching the TV programme, I've reread it recently and I've had a completely different experience. And I will be reading the Testaments. I'm in the middle of a book at the moment, but I will, as soon as I'm done, I will read the Testaments.
It's all right. I'm not that. Come on, yeah. Prove your feminism.
Well, I was on the bloody event the day after it had come out, and one of the people on the panel had read it already. I was like, how have you managed this?
Clearly, they don't have political obligations or responsibilities. It's really interesting to hear you say that, though, because I do think it's a book that you sort of... I mean, I do think it's brilliant. But again, I was quite a young teenager when I read it, and I think I felt, as you did, that because I'd read The Edible Woman first, which I found that much more kind of weird and engrossing, and I enjoyed the experience of reading it more. And my mum and dad hadn't read Atwood, and I think I got... The Edible Woman out of the library, and they read it, and then they got The Handmaid. Thought, oh, she's very good. Oh, feminism. And I was like, yes, very important.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get particularly feminist overtones, but I mean, the realising of it in the TV programme, certainly in the first series, which is, you know, much more to the book, it is, I mean, deeply feminist. And funnily enough, we were listening to Brave New World on the radio. We were driving back from Cornwall or somewhere with the kids, and it was the radio play of Brave New World was on. And it could have been written about now, even though it's what now, nearly 100 years old, it's getting on for.
Gosh,
and
yeah.
The Handmaid's Tale has that same effect of being timeless, totally timeless, that you could read it now and you can paste Trump onto it, you can... paste all of the violence against women and girls around the world that we now see and hear about much more. And so it is, imagine writing a book that stayed relevant for decades and decades. That is phenomenal.
I mean, I think she's angry about it. I don't think she wants it to be. He's like, that. Come on, this changed nothing.
Yeah, no, there's a brilliant woman who often comes to the protest that I see, and her sign just says, why am I still protesting this shit? It's just like, yeah, why is that we're having to say it over and over again?
Not to move away from the
seriousness of
it. I was thinking about the books that are timeless in different ways, and the books that you reread, and I see... Little one. All Sue Townsend.
All Sue Townsend. I am obsessed with Sue Townsend, and I have been since I was about 10 years old. So the first time I read Adrian Marlowe, I was about 10, I think, if not a bit younger. And I absolutely loved it. And I remember taking it into school. It might have been The Queen and I, actually, and I was reading that, which is the one that Sue Townsend wrote about the Queen ending up... There's like a communist coup and the Queen ends up living in a council house. With all the royal family, and it is very funny. And I remember taking it into school because I'd been reading it, and a teacher saying to me, you're too young to be reading that book. And so I wrote Sue Townsend a letter and said that my teacher had said I was too young to it, and she wrote back to me. I remember it vividly. It was like a pre-Raphaelite postcard, and it had a cat sticker on it, and she wrote, you're not too young, you read whatever you want whenever you want. But I absolutely, and I feel that they are timeless, even though it is written in Thatcher's Britain, the Adrian Mole books. I feel that they are totally timeless because as I have grown up, when I was a kid, I was like, oh my God, I want to be Pandora and her amazing treacle hair. And she's like the embodiment. And funnily enough, she does end up being a Labour MP, Pandora, in the later books. So I feel like maybe I did that because Pandora was guiding me. But now when I read it as somebody who has a son who is just 14, so has very recently been 13 and three quarters, that now I totally associate myself with everything that Pauline Mole says, the way she's just constantly rolling her eyes and tutting at Adrian for being not. I just find that absolutely delightful now, that now my absolute hero in the books is Pauline Mole. If I, you know, any literary character, Pauline Mole, Adrian's mom, is my lodestar.
Did she ever... I don't know that she did that, but I might have missed it. Was there ever...
just appalling, just appalling book. No, there wasn't. Yeah,
exactly.
I was thinking as well how, because whenever you speak about class, you are so compassionate and eloquent. And there's stuff that I found myself lazily thinking, and then I've listened to your words on it as well. Actually, I really need to kind of... I am the liberal elite and I must question everything. And
everybody is all right being everything that they are.
But I think it's so interesting the way that comes up in Adrian Moult. And obviously it's, you know, Thatcher times, but his sort of weird, like, the class aspirations. And I love the nuance of sort of how the Moult family, you know, sort of straddling several different classes. Absolutely. And he obviously wants to be more like Pandora and their...
sophisticated.
And, you know, so and all those weird kind of the class signifiers and the things we attach importance to. And it's weird how that hasn't changed.
Just even their house, isn't it? The sense of their house, Adrian's house, is always totally manic and crazy. And there's like old people coming and going. Whereas Pandora's house is like beige. And what you'd now imagine would be like Art from Next. and like they've got, you know, the car on the drive. And yeah, it is amazing. But also she's... what she does so brilliantly, Sue Townsend, is she punctures both of those things. She punctures the middle class. And so even now, when I'm thinking about Pandora's family, they're essentially nouveau riche, aren't they? They're essentially like, sort of like, oh, we're considerably better than you. Mm. Yeah. And actually, like I say, the hero of the piece is the working class family who are allowed to be brilliant and clever and politically engaged. But also there is no moral judgment on the chaos in their lives, the fact that, you know, he keeps running off with the stick insect, and you still feel a fondness to the characters, even though he's from a broken home. And the lovely old man, Bert, that he talks to is clearly a bit of a racist. Yeah. And it covers all life, I think, is what I really, really love about it.
I think that might have been the first book I read when I was like, oh, God, you know, grown-ups aren't just sorted people. And it's like they've not got, like, their job in life is to look after children. They've got very complex emotional unresolved lives.
Yeah, that is what is so brilliant about it, is that Adrian is merely one character and he thinks he's the center of the universe, but they have, like, and they get stuff wrong, and it's okay that they get stuff wrong. You very rarely get to see that portrayal of working class people anymore, and in the 80s you saw it so much more. You saw so many better representations of clever, witty, funny, hardworking or not hardworking, and both of those things being okay. Yeah. Like, they don't have to, you know, be down the mine to be virtuous. They can also be in the pub and be virtuous people. Mm. And you don't see that anymore, the sort of dole culture. If I think of Bread off the top of my head, you know, they were in the dole queue, they were literally in the dole office. But you never thought that Billy wasn't clever and funny and witty or knew what he was talking about. Whereas now the representation is of sort of pity almost. Mm. And I wish that it would go back to the working class that I grew up with, which is funny and brilliant. And my mum was literally from a single parent family. My granddad ran off with loads of floozies, as my nan used to say. And... you know, and did all, I mean, unimaginable. We always had loads of aunties instead of nans. So Auntie Ivy was one, and she looked like Bette Lynch. And she literally wore leopard prints and had a big blonde bouff on. But my granddad was a brilliant and funny character. And then my mum, who came from that environment, and my nan was a dinner lady and a single parent, and my mum became the person who read every single book on the Booker Prize list. So it just... it's not my reality that working class people aren't as clever, if not cleverer.
Going back to your mum and dad, you say about your dad being like, this is just the best book ever. When has that been true? And when have you read a book and you thought, no, Dad, this was not the one?
To be honest, I don't take many recommendations from him, because my dad is quite cerebral. My dad has definitely got the sort of affliction of being a clever kid from a different class, from a very working class background, where there is a definite need to better yourself. And so my dad reads lots of books that are not necessarily fiction books. They're like improving your... like he will read history books, like the sort of Silk Road stuff, and that is really sort of cerebral. Like he wants to learn constantly, my dad, and it is an amazing skill. But I have to say, I read for pleasure mainly, rather than to, you know, learn anything particularly new.
And well, I think that maybe comes back to, you know, what you're saying about sort of class, and that's all a bit miserable and joyless. And I think even across all classes, there's a real joy deficit that you're not allowed to just be funny and make jokes and, you know, be clever and have a nut. You've really got to kind of perform your own life all the time.
Absolutely.
Like, everything must be optimised.
Yeah, at the moment, that's definitely the case. Like, and everybody, like, everybody lies about the books that they've read. And so there are some books that everybody has to pretend to have read. Like, I mean, like books like 1984. Mm. You can't, I mean, you can't really exist in the world if you've not read 1984. But most of the people I No, haven't read 1984 and wouldn't have. But yeah, you're right. Everybody feels they have to perform constantly.
I love this that I've just spotted. You've got an SEO trot sandwich and you've got two copies of the Twits. And that, I think they're both, because these look like beautiful old...
Old copies, yeah. Mm. That, what you've got there is the marriage of two families, and where one is my childhood copy of the Twits and one is my husband's childhood copy of the Twits. And I think that if you were to ask my husband, there's quite a lot of the sort of the Dune books here, and the my husband's a massive science fiction lovey, so, and he's really into sort of dystopian literature and stuff. But I think that actually he might say a different book with, he might say Necromancer was his favourite book if you asked him. But actually, in reality, my husband's favourite book in the whole world is The Twits.
Oh!
And he's got a big beard, my husband. He's got a big black beard. And so he is a bit like Mr. Twit.
The things land in the beard.
Yeah, there's always some food in it. And sometimes if I say, oh, Tom, you've got something in your beard, he will, to annoy me, he will put more food into his beard. He will literally, like, get food and be like, I don't care, and put more food in his beard. But yeah, so The Twits is the book he refers to the most, and definitely the book he had the most joy in reading to our children over, again, over and over and over again.
Did they embrace Roald Dahl? Was The Twits their favourite, or did they land on any other?
No, I mean, my son Danny
is
the champion of the world. And when he was born, my friend bought me a brilliant illustration from Danny and the Champion of the World. And there it is, Danny, Champion of the World.
And I remember that spine so well. That was the one that was in... we had that in my classroom at school.
Yeah, I think that's probably...
Sure. Look, can I read
it's probably... Oh, there you go. That is for somebody else. It's just a book we've obviously got from a charity shop or a classroom that we've stolen. But that's not...
That's always a bit weird, like inscriptions on books when you find them in charity shops.
I mean, I've got absolutely loads, funnily enough. I've got absolutely loads of children's books, quite a lot of the Roald Dahl ones, like The Giraffe, The Pelly and Me. And when I open them, it is, this book belongs to, and it's a woman called Chris Furman, who was my reception teacher at infant school. And funnily enough, she is the mother of one of my best friends and the grandmother of my son's best friend's kids. So I feel this deep sense of joy when I open it, and it's one of the books that she'd obviously given to us when we were kids. But yeah, my kids, Danny, my son, my youngest son, absolutely loves Roald Dahl books. But he's recently, I suppose, maybe he read Boy and that's why, he's become very interested in Roald Dahl himself, about the man and about his life. So he will constantly... tell me facts. Maybe he's got this from my dad, that Danny likes facts about things, but he will constantly tell me facts about Roald Dahl. So he was talking to me the other day about how his daughter had died of measles. Yeah, he's fascinated by Roald Dahl himself. And I was in Tanzania recently on a delegation, and I went to the British embassy in Tanzania, and in that house is where Roald Dahl had lived. And there was a tree in the back garden that trees in one of the books had been based on, and I told my son Danny, and he was obsessed with this idea.
I think it's interesting as well, isn't it, the way it's really hard to separate. Should I sit down? But I feel like I'm just standing over you. Can't go.
Feel free to sit down.
That we
slightly messy bed.
Well, I really like this beautiful
again from a charity shop.
They have all the best stuff. I think it's really hard to read a story and just be they made it up. You want it to be a bit true. You want to be there to be a bit of the writer in there.
I think that all stories are a bit true. And what you think about, when I think about Roald Dahl specifically, you know, the way that adults are monstered. Adults are essentially, you know, the granny in George's Marvelous Medicine and the, you know, Miss Trunchbull in Matilda. I think that there must have been in his life some really awful teachers, or his parents must have been oppressive towards him, because children are like the key to everything in all of his books. So there must be truth in some of it.
Then I'm sure as well that's why, you know, he has endured and been, because that, you know, I think when you're little, there are moments when you really, really see the world like that, and it's sort of you versus them.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a story about how he'd, whatever public school he went to, in fact, I think it was around here, he went to one of the public schools around here, and on the way walking into the village, there was a sweet shop, and he used to like look in through the windows of the sweet shop, and that was like the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory thing, like the description of the sweets and how it had been magical to him. I really feel actually his life, his interesting and checkered life in his stories. I really love them. But Danny's favourite by a country mile is Matilda. By a country mile, that's his favourite book.
And that's really thrilling as well, isn't it? Because we, you know, generalise, and I'm not sure how true this is in a sort of, you know, child by child basis, but it's kind of thought that like girls have no problem loving superheroes and loving sort of characters that seem to be male, but it's harder for some reason for boys to flip it for all kinds of reasons of conditioning. But it's, I think that's right, because Matilda is so, I love her because she doesn't get mad, she gets even. Yeah. She's got this absolutely right, but she's able to kind of stand back and not, you know, and sort of see this sort of injustice and just be very, very, rather than feel her frustrations.
Yeah, I think that
it's very clever about expressing them.
If you could be any character from literature as a sort of young feminist, you would be Matilda, because she's so powerful. I mean, not literally because she has powers that are odd, but because she literally, everything about her is powerful. She allows herself to be powerful and believes it, and she's the best character ever. But funnily enough, my son Danny much prefers stories with girls as the protagonists. And so, like the Amber Spyglass and all of those. So, and in fact, my husband absolutely, and I, we all love the Dark Materials books. And my mum absolutely loved them. And I remember thinking, aren't they kids' books? Because they're the point, like point horror when you were a teenager. Yeah, we all absolutely loved them. But if anything, the final one, I'm less keen on, because I think that Lyra doesn't shine as much. Mm. I think that Lyra is the best thing about the books. Yeah, I think Danny much prefer, his favourite film is The Wizard of Oz. So he likes a female central character.
That is a pretty great favourite film to pick. It's got everything, The Wizard of Oz.
I know, it's really odd. He's loved it ever since he was like three.
Has he read the book?
I don't think he has read the book. Is it a good book?
I was absolutely freaked out by it, I think, because I remember it being something where, you know, you sort of see the film, love the film, and then, oh, well, you know, you should read this if you like the film so much, and being just a bit chilled and a bit frightened and a little bit like, have you ever read Mary Poppins?
I was about to say, I remember reading Mary Poppins in my school library. In my school library, it was like, I was like, oh, I'll read this on a rainy day, and being like, she's horrible. Yeah, Mary Poppins is sinister, I think.
So sinister.
I mean, it's because it was Julie Andrews, I suppose. You can't make Julie Andrews sinister. That would be quite something to make Julie Andrews sinister.
I wonder if they tried and she just couldn't do it. Okay, we'll rewrite it.
Incapable of, being horrible.
What, did you read the Point Horrors as a teen?
Yes, what was your... I read them all, but I can't...
Sorry, I'm not going to say.
Which one is my favourite? I don't know, I can't remember any of them. I read all that sort of thing. So I read the Point Horrors. I never read the Sweet Valley High books so much. I think I read one or two. I read Judy Blume books, all of those teenagey books. I feel like when I was a teenager, there was a real... That was really the sort of beginning of that whole teen genre. We read all of those and we passed them around in class for the rude bits.
The book that gets mentioned the most on this podcast is Forever by Judy Blume. Well, and everyone says that it was the one copy shared between 30 girls.
Exactly, we definitely used to talk about it in class. But it is, I mean, now, actually, I think in modern times, to write like Judy Blume did about relationships and teenagers sort of coming of age, to write about it without some of the darker side that almost all teenagers go through, I think would be difficult. So it's good, you know, I would want to see, I wish that I'd had known some of the things that I know now when I was a teenage girl.
Book that she wrote that I think it's called starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, and it's her younger end. So I think it's for younger readers then, so things like Forever. But it's about, I think it's immediately after the war, and it's a family. I think they maybe moved to Long Island, possibly Florida, and they are, I think, Italian, and they move to a very sort of anti-Semitic neighbourhood, and they've got Jewish friends, and it's all about how that plays out into the post-war. And it's really, it's so, I've written for sort of 10-year-olds, but it's great, and it really...
Well, there's lots of brilliant children's books that tackle issues over racism and gender, and, I mean, unfortunately, we have run up against some of it in recent months around whether certain religious groups feel that it's acceptable for their children to be reading books that are about equality and gay and lesbian people.
I know it's not the same thing at all, really, but I was thinking about that teacher telling you not to read Sue Townsend, and I think that really lights a fire in a kid, you know, when you say you can't have this.
Totally. I've literally read every single thing that Sue Townsend has ever written, like 100 times. I feel that maybe that I was just really trying to prove that point, so that I can read Sue Townsend. But yeah, I think that if you tell people not to want to read this... I remember when I was a kid was when the Satanic Verses thing all came out. I have no desire to read the Satanic Verses now. And at the time, I had no idea what it was about. I must have been about 11. And I was like, I'm going to read this book because I'm being told that it's bad. And I mean, I would have been lost if I'd read even, like, 3 pages. But I remember that, and I remember Madonna's sex book when that came out. I remember vividly, like, being, like, yeah, 10 years old and being like, what is this sex book? Because it came in, like, a cellophane wrapper, didn't it, in the shop. So you couldn't just go into the shop and have a rifle through it.
Did you get to look at a copy?
I did, because at the time, funnily enough, we used to have loads of lodgers, and but at the time there was a bloke called John, and he was going through a divorce, and he worked with my mum, and he came to live with us, and it was probably about a year after the controversy, but he had a copy of the Madonna sex book, and I remember being like, yes, finally, I can look at the Madonna sex book.
Did you have to kind of sneak it out if it was...
To be honest, I feel then, as I do now, it was a bit tame. I was a bit like, it's a bit like when you watch Sex and the City. You hoped for more of the sex, less of the city. And so, yeah, I remember being a bit like, not sure what all the fuss was about in the Madonna sex book.
That's something that I'm sort of trying to get my head around now when you think, you know, because I know, you know, and rightly, because it's very, very worrying, but we talk a lot about what children and teenagers can access and how explicit is and how much of it there is and how problematic it is in terms of the way that people and acts sort of presented. But I mean, not that long ago you'd wait a whole year to see a picture of a fanny.
Exactly, of Madonna's fanny. I mean, I think it's special because it was Madonna's. But yeah, you're right. I mean, now my kids can just go on their phones and the whole world of porn is available to them.
And Google image search Madonna's fanny.
Also, I think that there was an element of when you're coming of age, when you're a teenager, where people used to read smutty books for that exact reason, because that was part of, as Catelyn Moran talks about this brilliantly, the part of the sort of awakening of lots of teenage girls' sexuality. I don't know, I've never been a teenage boy, was, you know, you were reading books and people were having sex in them. And I remember when Lady Chatterley's Lover came out on the telly and being like, oh, I'm gonna take that book upstairs, like, let's read this book. Again, disappointing.
Yes. It is, and all of G.H. Lawrence, I'm like, are they having sex or not? The flowers and metaphors, and what I don't, what's going on?
I remember in reading Thomas Hardy at school, and then I came to the conclusion that all English teachers were just obsessed with sex, because they would say that everything was sex in every book. They're like, oh, the moist grass, that's sex. I'm like, I think it's just grass, miss.
That, and it's like things like with Thomas, like if a character's got dark hair, it means that she's wild and promiscuous.
Yes,
or
yeah,
if she's in a stream, she wants to have sex. And if she's got a basket, it symbolises a vagina.
Yeah, that is exactly what my English teacher told me. And I was thinking, miss, I think maybe she just had something to carry. And that's why she had a basket. But then, like, so we read Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and then in the actual scene, which is of sexual violence rather than actual sex, there's nothing. I was like, you've been telling me this whole book is about sex, and in the actual sex scene bit, no sex at all. This is fundamentally, you've told me everything is about sex and then there isn't actually any sex in it. Obviously, at the time, it would have been smutty to write about sex. But yeah, and then all of my English teachers got pregnant whilst I was going through school. And so we were just convinced that they were just total nymphos, English teachers.
Like, oh, I've read this spicy passage of James Hardy.
Exactly.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Jess soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a wordy wonder that would definitely count as your big present if you were to put it on your Christmas list. This week, it's Wedding Toasts I'll Never Give by Ada Calhoun. This is a book of essays. The title essay is the piece Ada wrote for the New York Times Modern Love column, an essay that garnered such an enormous response that the book couldn't not be written. This is one of my favourite books. It's tender, romantic, often painful, shocking and funny. This is about what happens after A Happy Ever After. It's about the quietness of love and about the gaps in our imagination and perception when it comes to what we believe lasting love to be versus what it actually is. I truly believe this book will enhance your relationship or your marriage. Just ask producer Dale. In all seriousness, I think about these words often and I love them. To hitch your rickety wagon to the flickering star of another valuable human being, what an insane thing to do, what a burden and what a gift. That's Wedding Toasts I'll Never Give by Ada Calhoun, published by Norton and out now. Now, back to Jess.
Did you, because I know that in How to Be a Woman, Catelyn Moran talks a lot about Gilly Cooper. I'm a very big Gilly Cooper fan, and that was filling in the gaps that Thomas Hardy couldn't reach. Have you read?
I have never read any Gilly Cooper, but my friend Jess is totally obsessed with them. Like, she's like, gets it on the first day. I haven't, but I feel that I should. I've also never read any Jackie Collins. Oh. And again, my mates on holiday, they all are reading some Jackie Collins novel or not, because they're the ones that get left in the book exchange, or like get left in the holiday home. There's always a Jackie Collins, so somebody will always read a Jackie Collins. In fact, I remember my friend Marcella, when we were on holiday once, reading this Jackie Collins book, like The Stud or something, and it had been left in the flat we were staying in, and then it didn't have the last 8 pages. She's like, what? This is like a torture. This is total torture. I was like, I'm fairly sure those copies are widely available elsewhere.
I really love that, though. I think especially when you do get sort of stuck and you end up reading like a John Grisham that you never would have read otherwise.
And sometimes it's totally amazing. I read Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy that way. It was like and I was like, it's so atmospheric. Ooh. And I would never read the blurb of that and be like, yeah, I'm going to read this. I would never, ever, as soon as it's like, it's set in the Civil War England or whatever, I'm like, bah! Anything that's really boyish, I'm like, I'm not reading this. And I would never have read Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, because spy novels, I would just be like, whatever. But I absolutely, it is a genius piece of writing.
Okay, afterwards, or did you just let that?
I've read The Constant Gardener. Is that like a Oh, is that Le Carré? Yeah. I've read that one, but that was because my mum really, really liked that one. My mum loved Murder. She didn't read it, maybe, and this is the reason I've never read Jilly Cooper or Jackie Collins, is because my mum didn't read them and I just got all my books from her. But she was an absolute, the sort of, if we were going to be snobby about it, the sort of trashy novel. She would read loads of spy and murder mysteries. So she would like all of the Ruth Rendell books, like when I was a kid. And then there were like the Ruth Rendell mysteries on the telly. But luckily, because my mum couldn't remember anything from her book, she never knew who had done it on the TV, even though she'd read the book.
When there are so many as well, they all kind of like, oh, is this the one where the dog? Oh, no, that's Agatha Christie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so that's why I never read those. But I read lots of murder mystery novels when I was a kid. But less so now. Now, I have to say, the books I read now are much more, like, I don't care what people think about what I read, and I just want to escape, but not like fantasy. My escape is reading about 30-something women, obviously. It's not that escapist. But because my life is complicated and difficult and I see harrowing things at work and have done ever since I worked at Women's Aid and still do today, I really don't want to read about horrible things happening to people, because I see it enough all the time. And when rereading The Handmaid's Tale and actually watching the drama of it as well, being able to, reading it was okay, but watching women being held down and sexually assaulted when I know people that has happened to, I found it really, really difficult. So now I tend to read what people would term chick lit, and I read books about, like, I mean, it's the best
commercial fiction.
Yeah, but so I love Aaron Keyes, and I absolutely love Mari McFarlane.
Oh my god, I love her. She's brilliant.
And me and my mates are all like, "Oh, have you seen the new ones come out?" And we like, I just think it's really, she's really funny and really clever.
Dialogue as well. Yeah. What I love about her is the friends are never supporting characters. She writes really, really real friendships.
And I have to say, on screen, I almost never see friendships that I can believe in. I suppose Fleabag, it was a sort of change away from that, but in books, when friendships are written so much better, especially female friendships, the dialogue between female friendships in Mari McFarlane, compared to if you rewatch things like Sex and the City with four women, nobody talks like that. Like, it's, people are so stilted on TV. Even I remember watching Mamma Mia and just thinking, people are not friends like this. This is so weird, the way you're behaving.
So bizarre about Sex and the City is they all seem to believe that sort of they are best friends with Carrie, but they don't really have much in the way of relationships with each other. And it's just odd. Yeah, it's really odd.
It is, yeah. You never see, like, Samantha out with Miranda.
And they're sort of a bit snippy with each other, and it's
I really, really love Mari McFarlane, but I think that Irish writers, they write in a certain way. So Sally Rooney, her book about, and the fact that the characters were these Irish, in the most recent one, Normal People.
Brilliant. I'm so glad, because I've just finished reading that, and I was writing something, and I was really, really nervous that it was going to kind of get in my head, and I was accidentally going to just write a shit version of Normal People. So, like, no, put it away, move away. And now I'm like, I have so many questions. I just don't know how I feel about it. I don't know what I think.
I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved the male character whose name now currently escapes me, Connor, because he is like lads I knew in that era. I like that none of them are blousy. The thing I'm going to say about Normal People that is, I would say, the best thing about it is that the sex in it is really well written. Is really well written. And it is realistic, but not like awkward realistic, like you might see in, like, How to Be Famous by Kathleen Moran, where it's very realistic about bad sexual experiences.
Oh my God. Is it How to Be Famous or How to Build a Girl? And there's the description of... I might need producer Dale's help. Do you mean Bernie Winters and the
Schnorbits?
Yes. Dog. And there's something about the who was it who was kind of like had one of those like fake ostriches?
Oh, Bernie Clifton.
Bernie Clifton. And it's a sex position being like Bernie Clifton and his ostrich. And I laughed about that for about 5 days straight.
Well, it is brilliantly funny.
I loved Normal People. I loved it. But my real struggle is that, you know, the relationships are so bleak and abusive, but I had that Connor's refusal to acknowledge her, I just can't, it just broke me.
I get that. How is he the hero of the piece when he was just so fundamentally bad and wrong at the beginning? But now I actually feel total sympathy. Well, not, he wasn't bad to her.
He was, you know, 17, 18-year-old lad, and that's what...
That's what they do.
Yeah.
And I think that I really loved Connor because I knew Connor. You know, it was like a boy I'd known who was sweet and charming and...
Because I think that's it. Sort of at the beginning, I kind of got it. And then it's just later on when he was a little bit inconsistent about things. And I think some of it was about a lack of courage or a lack of confidence. And it's about the way men are expected to be in the world. And that's not fair. But, oh, God, and her brother. That's because I think it was so... I think she's a writer of omission.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of it is in what is left out. And that's what she does. So, but chilling.
And yeah, just like it. But as somebody who worked with abused women for so many years, the way that she presented the central character was more realistic than when you can see and hear the action of what might be happening to that person. To watch a person disappear and change physically and just their character change is the reality that I have seen over the years of working with women who are very badly put upon. So I absolutely loved it. I was on the judging panel of the bookseller awards and it won because I really fought for it. I really fought for it because I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved it.
And again, I think that's a story... Because I know it has been criticised for being slight, but I feel as though...
short. I mean, slight in what regard?
Well, I think it's... There is so much there, and her, you know, skill is that she says so much and so little. That's what you want. That's what you don't want, you know, to wade through extraneous, like, and the trees were this. Yeah. But I think this is a really great time now for those books for women to be treated with respect. I think that maybe even 10 years ago, normal people would have been a sort of maybe labelled as chick lit and dismissed as such. Do you know there's a book that just got Anna Hope, Expectation? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, I think you'd really love it. It's three women in their 30s. It's sort of a little bit...
I think I'm reading that at the moment. This is the trouble, that I constantly read books that I don't know what the name is and I don't know who's written it because I read it on a Kindle and it usually is at 2 o'clock in the morning that I just go, whatever Amazon has said, I will like... And so I'm reading a book about three women and one of them can't have a baby.
And one of them really wants to. And one is the actress.
I'm literally reading that book at the moment. Yeah, don't spoil it.
I won't say anything.
I don't know how far through I am either. That's the trouble with reading a book on a Kindle. I have no sense of how much more I've got to read.
So do you ever sort of get brilliant. To the end and be like, I wanted more?
What I really, really like about them is that because it switches in time... between the past and the present, or actually still the past, but what is the present in the book, is that the way that their relationship is changing, where some of them are really, really close at some points and some of them have fallen out, and that they're like pissed off with each other. Because that is how my experience of female friendships, that in a group, you switch and change and allegiances change and everybody's slagging this person off for this for a bit and everybody's slagging that person off for that for a bit. I absolutely love that book. Isn't it awful that I didn't know that was the name of the book I was reading?
No,
it didn't happen.
I love it because it's so easy now. It's like, oh yes, of course, Expectations on it. And just to be like, well, you know, whatever this is, I've just... love it, it's great.
Yeah, well, I often the way I read is because I don't sleep very well and I wake fretfully in the night because, you know, I have a difficult life. I don't have a difficult life, I have a troubling job. And so I always read to put myself to sleep, which means now that I actually read books really slowly because as soon as I start reading a book, I start to fall asleep. Even if it's the middle of the day, it is literally like sort of Pavlov's dog, I will just fall asleep. And so often... I will literally just go to whatever next is recommended and I buy books completely without, not even judging them by the cover. It is a lot, I'll read the top three lines and if it doesn't sound like something that I'd be interested in, I'll discard it. It's a bit like Tinder. Yeah, swipe to the left.
I think that might be a multi-billion-dollar business idea. Tinder for books.
Tinder for books, yeah.
But you're so right, though, about the things that matter, even sort of between your 20s and 30s, and that it's going through these two periods that aren't that far apart, but actually, so their priorities have changed.
Yeah, and they seem wildly different. What I think is interesting about it is for women in their 30s reading this book, there is a huge amount of parallel with, you know, most women will be able to see themselves in one of the characters at one of the points of time, not necessarily all the way through. But for me, what is interesting about reading it is that their 30s are so markedly different from their 20s, even though it's not that far apart, because I had my children when I was 22, my first child. So I had this sort of sense of arrested development or progressed development where when I'm reading about them in their 20s, I think, God, I just was wiping people's arses and cleaning nappies when I was in my 20s, and how that has made my relationships with women in my 30s when they're all having babies different.
Have you read, do you know that Marion Keyes book, Sushi for Beginners? Because yes. I love the friendship and Claudette, and the thing that breaks my heart in that is her being sort of, Claudette sort of having everything and yet being so empty and so unhappy, and then being desperate to go out and have a wild time with Ashling, and she's like, I've been working 14 hours straight.
Yeah, I just don't want to do it. Well, that is the reality, isn't it, of women's lives. And I think that, funnily enough, reading the book that I'm currently reading, whatever, Expectations, there you go, I was really pleased that it is completely different to Sally Rooney. It is much more flowery in its language. Mm. It, like, leans into setting the scene all the time. And it's not extraneous, but it's definitely there. And that it isn't like a sort of chick lit just being rushed nowadays. It is that this sort of talking about women, it is allowed to be brilliantly written and clever. And
sort of treated as, I'm doing air quotes here, literary fiction. Rather, and it's so, and I think it's so weird, the labels we give to books that are supposed to get them into people's hands, but actually can put people off. And I understand as, I mean, I don't know how you feel as an author. I mean, you must talk about your book before in your, whether there's, you know, there are conversations about kind of like where you sit in the bookshop and what, and how you feel about that and how.
I mean, I don't, it's a whole world I don't understand, if I'm honest, because whilst I am, when you describe me as being an author, to me that just seems outrageous, the thought of being an author, even though I've now written two books, because I still just see myself as a politician who happens to have written some books. But when I go to the meetings with the publishers and all the different people who are sitting around the table, I sort of have given in to the idea that I just don't understand anything that any of them are talking about, or that, and I always say in the acknowledgements, thanks to all these people, because I didn't know what the hell was going on throughout this. I will just write stuff and then I assume you know what you're up to, because I don't really understand this. But yeah, how it fits and where it fits. And it's, but if you write non-fiction as well, as I do, where it sits in the market, whether it's which age group it's meant to be for, it's when I'm writing, I do try and have a sense of who I'm writing it for. And so the first book I wrote, I definitely had like a young, from teenage to upwards woman in my head. Like, and I wanted it to be accessible to teenage girls as much as it is to a 30-something-year-old woman, because there's big bits about motherhood and all that sort of thing, which, you know, as a teenager, you're probably like, oh yeah, whatever, you're going to go and have babies. But when I was a teenager, that's what teenagers did. And writing my second book, trying to think who I was talking to all the time, I think I wouldn't be able to write it if I didn't have a person. And so this sort of very idea of an every person, like an ordinary person who just feels like they want to do something and doesn't know what is the person I was talking to in my second book. You know, just ordinary people, the kind of people who watched This Morning, I suppose, as well as people who are already slightly activated politically or not just politically, but activated by a cause, but without thinking about who you're going to write it for. But then when it gets involved in marketing and that, it becomes a, you know, so I just did a thing for the Sunday Times. I don't know that I was talking to a Sunday Times audience when I wrote it. Do you know what I mean? That it is weird the way that it will pan out, it depending on what you thought it was going to be and what they think is the best place to place you in the market.
And I guess there's lots of authors, you know, really, I mean, doing lots of very, you know, busy full lives, and they're all great. But I think I would guess that compared with most people who write books, you are talking to people sort of constantly and constantly really aware of who these people are that you're addressing the book to in an unignorable way, whereas for lots of people there's a lot more kind of guesswork.
I think for lots of people it is there's a much more insular process to writing a book, and they it is much more personal in lots of ways, even though my first book was very personally about lots of things in my life. It is much more personal and sort of, yeah, like blinkers on, I'm going to get my head down and write this, I feel it needs saying, or I think it's a great story. Whereas, yeah, for me, it changes literally daily based on the conversations that I'm having with people in the country or people at work. Because, and I have this, I wish I knew how to do this more in a more fancy way, notes or saying something. I have a hilarious set of text messages that I've sent myself. And so obviously you get it twice because I've sent it and I've received it. The only way I know how to keep it in a record, where it will just be literally like, I'll suddenly be like, do this about abortion or something, because somebody has come in and just spoken to me about their experience. And I feel all this, last night I had to get up in the middle of the night and write something down. Because I feel it's like constantly, like the day's experiences of dealing with people in difficult circumstances, people struggling or people achieving, actually, people succeeding, yeah, regardless of circumstance. It's like every day you are constantly responding to that and putting it into what you write. I write best when I'm angry, it has to be said. I have to be really quite cross. If I'm not cross, I don't really have anything to say. And somebody once gave me a piece of advice, is only write something if you've got something to say about it. Don't like get a brief and just feel like you have to fill the page. And so I write much better when I'm really, really, really cross.
So how was the writing process? Were you sort of having to get really cross every day?
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities for crossness in my life. And sometimes when, I mean, the writing process is horrendous. I found it much easier the first time, although that may well just be like when you give birth. The first time, you convince yourself when you're about to do it the second time that it wasn't that bad, and that there's something in your brain that switches off. Because my husband said I was a massive pain in the ass the first time as well.
There's a lot to be said in life, isn't there, for not knowing what to expect and just thinking it's going to be dreadful.
Exactly. And so I found the first book just sort of fell out of me, and the second book, there were times when I was just like, trying to tell people how to speak up without both patronising them, teaching them sometimes to teach their granny to suck eggs, because everybody is actually, you know, ploughing their own furrow in their own lives. And also without it constantly, my constant thought in my head was, don't make it hyperbolic. Like, don't, it has to constantly seem realistic to people to be able to do it. And even though the examples of the people who I interviewed in the book, what they did was, you know, is unbelievable. They're taking on governments, taking on whole council areas and police forces, taking on, you know, huge, long-standing divisions in society. But they were all very ordinary people. Mm. And I had to try and constantly come back from the edge of being too inspired by them, because the whole point was, you can do it. And constantly trying to look up and make sure you're speaking to the audience, not just having basically a love letter to this amazing activist that you love. And that is hard.
I think it's such a weird time for that, isn't it? Because I feel like these two things are polarised. Well, either it's like, look at this amazing, but it's always like, you know, look at Oprah, look at Beyonce, this is what you should be achieving. And then the other side is, sorry, I'm a bit shit. And there's not really a way of marrying, and being a bit shit is supposed to be this sort of authentic thing that we're all... Like, I'm not apologising for apologising, but I am apologising. It's sort of insane, like Hall of Mirrors, feminine inversion. I don't know, feminist inversion, rather. I don't know what is going on with that. But yeah, it sounds like your book is the answer.
I'm going to sit here and say, yes, it is. I don't think that you have to be perfect. And I don't think that you also... I don't think, you know, all people... I'm so deeply in love with people, all of them. I am fascinated by people. I think, you know, just... Thomas Paine, I think, said, people are my religion. That is how I feel.
Fleabag, people are all we have.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just...
You're Thomas Paine, I'm Fleabag.
Yeah, well, I'd rather be Fleabag. I'm so fascinated by them. But I don't want people to think that things are unachievable for them. Because, yes, you're probably never going to end up being Oprah Winfrey. It's very uncommon that you get to be Beyoncé Knowles. But also you shouldn't want to be, I suppose, is the point, is that, you know, be a legend in your own lunchtime. It is very, very difficult, though, that this either you are a hero or you're in the bin.
Mm.
And nobody exists in that space, not even Beyoncé. I bet sometimes she proper belongs in the bin. I bet she's like, has an off day and is like a nightmare to
Beyoncé
everybody.
Definitely had KFC crumbs in her eyebrows secretly, but I'm sure she has.
Exactly. And most people exist in the middle. Mm. Good and bad, whether you agree with them or not. So I'm fascinated by people that I don't agree with and vehemently don't agree with me. I'm still fascinated by what got them there and who they are and all of that stuff. So
all of the tiny, tiny things informing their lives and building up that.
People's lives are amazing tapestry. And because in my job and the jobs that I've had before, you get an immense privilege of getting to be trusted in people's lives to try and help them. And you get... You essentially a job for the nosy. You have privileged information on people's lives all the time, and that is it builds a huge. So you're sort of like death eating is how I sometimes describe it. When you come across as many people as I do, and with as many varied life experiences as I come across, it's sort of like you're absorbing constantly people's brilliance, even if they've come in to moan about the bins. Which, believe you me, is more common than anything else.
This is a bit of a putting you on the spot question, but thinking of all the books you've read, if there was a character you could sort of persuade to go into politics, someone who'd sort of, you know, change the Labour Party and the country for the better and work with you, who would you like to recruit?
Who would I like to get? I mean, I naturally would want to say Pauline Mole. I think she would have made an amazing politician. I like to think she would have been a bit like me. She would have been like, no nonsense. Like, why are we still talking about this? Because that's what she's like with Adrian all the time. So, yeah, maybe Pauline Mole. I'm actually Matilda.
Mm.
Matilda, the world needs a Matilda character. And maybe, maybe the Prime Minister of New Zealand, maybe she's our Matilda. She seems to be Matilda-esque. I'd say those two.
That really gives me hope, that idea. That makes me feel very optimistic.
The
time it's hard to be.
Would be an amazing Prime Minister. She would basically just roll her eyes and tut at people and just crack on with just getting on with things. I think she would be brilliant. And also, all that scandal, she'd just be like, whatever, and just be smoking a fag around the back of 10 Downing Street. That would be amazing.
Did you ever meet Sue Townsend?
I didn't. Oh. I would absolutely have looked. So Jonathan Ashworth, the MP for one of the Leicesters, he said she lived down the street from him.
Oh.
And... I recently was driving through Ashby de la Zouche, and I feel that it should definitely have a statue of Adrian Mole in Ashby de la Zouche, but it's got a Tory MP, and so when I asked him about it, Andrew Bridgen, I said, he was like, you know, it's bloody communist nonsense sort of thing. I was like, no, how could you have, Adrian Mole was from my constituency. I would be pasting that everywhere. I mean, Tolkien's from Birmingham. So in parts of my constituency, it's all like, you know, the Hobbit land and everything. And people are really, really proud of it. But if Adrian Mole was from my constituency, I just think I would be so, so proud. The fact that he was from they started off living in Leicester and then they moved to Ashby de la Zouche. Even that is just because it's a funny name and it sounds sort of like we've gone up in the world. We live in Ashby de la Zouche. Even that is brilliant.
It just sounds a bit made up, doesn't it?
God, she's just so excellent. I read a thing as well that she said that just before, because she'd gone blind, hadn't she? And there's a character latterly who goes blind in the books. And I read a brilliant interview with her and she said, "What was?" Is the thing that always makes you happy. And she just said, you know, finding a packet of fags where there is one left in it. And I remember just thinking, that always makes me happy. And, you know, like colouring pencils, like a box of fresh colouring pencils. I just thought, this woman, I just love everything about her. She is my absolute hero. I don't know that I'd be able to cope if I'd ever met her. I can think of nobody I look up to more than Sue Townsend. I love her.
It sounds like a sort of a carrying part of her soul. There's, you know, there are so many parallels. And just when you sort of someone writes something and you're like, that, it's like it's me, but it's you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God, I just absolutely love... And I wish that, you know, actually what I would wish... I could have talked to her about the bits where Pandora goes on, in the much later books where Pandora goes on to be a new Labour MP and she's there in like furs and things with her amazing hair. I just, yeah, I would like to have sat and talked to her about what she felt about those years of the Labour government. Oh, I just absolutely love her.
Huge thanks to Jess for being on the podcast and for giving me hope in trying times. Follow her on Twitter at Jess Phillips and do read Truth to Power. At a time when it sometimes feels impossible to do anything good, I genuinely believe that Jess's words will inspire us all to change the world for the better a little bit. I'm Daisy Buchanan and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, Tome Raiders. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with this, attributed to Virginia Woolf. Secondhand books are wild books, homeless books. They have come together in vast flocks of variegated feather and have a charm which the domesticated volumes of the library lack. Also, secondhand books are books you can justify buying 10 at a time. See you soon!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.